Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule. It's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed. No real news since the last episode. I'm at sea. I've not been anywhere except heading across the Atlantic. It's now the 25th of December, Christmas Day. Woohoo! That doesn't really mean much to me. I'm performing on stage this evening and just working. So I'm just going to get straight into the review because I've not really got much to talk about. Keep emailing though, luke@juggler.net if you got any feedback and things like that. It's just I've not been not got very much since the last podcast. I guess people are away and doing Christmassy things, unlike me. Anyway, so the book that I'm reviewing this time out, I've just read or listened to the audiobook. It's called The Speed of Dark by Elizabeth Moon and published in, let me have a look here, 2005. And it's around about 369 pages, it says here on goodreads.com. That works out to around about 14, 15 hours as an audiobook. I just noticed here, Literary Awards, Nebula Award for Best Novel 2003. I didn't know that. I guess it's published in 2003. The mass market paperback that I have here on goodreads.com is 2005. So 2003 Nebula Award winner. I didn't know it won the Nebula Award, but maybe I should actually read up a little bit more about the background of some of these books before just diving in here. Anyway, so yes, I decided to read this because Jesse mentioned it on. I dropped an epic 2-hour SFF audio podcast in the feed a few months ago, and he said it was really interesting. He listened to about half of it, hadn't finished it yet, and he says it's interesting reading a book told from the point of view of someone with autism or some kind of spectrum disorder. And we had a discussion about the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime by Mark Haddon and different things like that. But I thought, hey, I'll just give it a go. I tried downloading it once and it didn't work out, and then I just downloaded it again, and and of course I was put a little bit of a breaks on my listening to this by breaking my iPhone, but I've been trying out this new iPod Nano and it's working really, really well. It's really cute, tiny little thing. But it's great for practicing, and when I'm juggling and gets in the way a lot less when I can just clip it to my clothes and stuff like that. It's really cool. Yes, this book, it's a bit strange actually, because it's, like I say, told from the point of view of someone who has autism or Asperger's syndrome or something like that, in the same way, in a similar way to, say, Flowers for Algernon by Daniel Keyes, and which is, I guess, one of the most famous books of portraying someone with some kind of mental illness. And, of course, you've got to draw comparisons to, you know, Flowers for Algernon and even The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime as well. But it's a bit strange because in those cases, you're sort of like, especially, well, you're always thinking, is this how someone with Asperger's syndrome, with autism, thinks? Or, you know, with Flowers for Algernon, that's only part of the, you know, part of the story. And it's more about the development of the writing style and things like that. Actually, I started reading Flowers for Algernon this morning. I'll save any discussion for that until the next episode, which I'm sure I'll review that. But it's a bit strange in this because this is actually set in the future where there's already some partial cures for people with any kind of autism or brain disorder. It tells the story of some people, or at least one person, who was part of this lost generation, because it's set, like I say, in the decades to come, not really quite sure how far in the future. There's a financial crisis and people are talking about that, and they're talking about what happened at the beginning of the 21st century. And in some ways companies and have more power, but in some ways they have less power. And there's global warming as well, like trees are dying and because of global warming, and there's no green leaves or anything like that. And it's set in a sort of generic American city, but there's mass transit and you know, less people drive cars. They talk about how people these days, or that he lives in one of the characters lives in an apartment building, and it was built when everyone has cars, so there's lots of parking, but now people don't have so many cars anymore, and things like that. And there's other things that happen. It's slowly revealed throughout the novel, because at the beginning you don't really pay the main character, who, like I say, has some kind of spectrum disorder, doesn't really pay that much attention or doesn't feel it's important to tell that kind of thing. And I just presumed it was like set in the current world in a way, but it isn't. And this is the key thing. It's because it's set in a world where if you are young, or if you've just been born and you've got any kind of these autism disorders, you can have some gene therapy and it gets healed. And anyone who is older than the characters in this book have got sort of like autism as we know it today because they weren't caught when they were young. But this lost generation, in a way, is the kids who weren't, who were like old enough to have their autism diagnosed and treated at a young age, but not treated in a way that cures it completely, like people younger than them, but treats it better than the people older than them who don't, aren't as capable. They're very more disabled. So the autism that's being portrayed in this book isn't the autism that we know today. And it's not any autism that I would recognize, even if I did recognize how autistic people think. And I don't have a lot of experience with how people with autism think, you know, just only by pop references. I did once work as a carer at a daycare center for mentally and physically disabled people, but to be honest, I'm not entirely sure what kind of disorders all of those had. It was like, 10 years ago now? No, 2001. So yeah, 9 years ago when I was working with that. And so I understand, you know, and I have worked with people like this, but I don't know really how they see the world, even though that's the main part or the main focus of this book, and like I say, the curious incident of the dog in the nighttime as well, and other books like this. So it's a bit strange. I don't really want to talk about if this is a good portrayal of Asperger's syndrome or autism or anything like that, because I don't think it's meant to be a realistic portrayal how we know. But I do think it's very close, or it's certainly a very interesting thing. I'll get a bit more into that. So the setting, like I said, is a vague location in this, like I say, in a vague time. And it does, as I said before, reflect, because I skip ahead in my notes here, it reflects the mind of the protagonist, because it's, like I say, slowly revealed. He is, you know, it's sort of a vague setting, but it's very restricted in scale. He works, he goes to work and he works in this research unit, the main character, Lou, his name, and then he goes home and then he goes back to work and then he goes home and then he goes to a friend's house and then he goes home, then he goes to the community center and then he goes to the store and then he goes to the police station and then he goes home. And it's sort of like every part is, we don't really even know if he's rich or if he lives in an affluent area or anything like that, mainly because his mindset, he doesn't really think about that. When he sees stuff, he doesn't see the details that we would see, and he sees other details. So in some ways the setting is very well described, but not very usefully described as it would be in most novels, where you sort of get inside a character's head and you sort of see how they see it and things like that, which I guess I'll get onto a bit more later as well. I've made some more notes about that for later. Anyway, so the story is, you got Lou, and his name is, I don't know, maybe it'll be here on the Goodreads page. Yes, Lou Arundale. And so he works in a pharmaceutical company. And as far as I can tell, he sort of works with proteins and he sees patterns in proteins or, you know, drugs or something like that. And, you know, pattern recognition, because that's what he's sort of like he's a high functioning autistic person. So he is, so he can still work and he can drive to and from work and he lives by himself and he can look after himself quite well. But Lou works in this unit, which is set up in a company if these companies employ disabled people, they get tax breaks. And also these autistic people are very good at what they do, some kind of, you know, working with computers, working with programs, working with patterns and trying to recognize. I always think about it, it's like this, one of these things is of folding proteins. It's something that humans can do because we see like the whole thing as a, as sort of like a whole unit and folding up, and you can recognize in advance about what things will fit in where. But computer models don't do that very well because they can only do it iteratively, and it's one of these things like the SETI at home project, where you put across your computer power to look through data and search for alien signals. There's another one which you can do with protein folding and things. So I reckon like Lou is, that's the kind of thing that he does to work out and to sort of sequence proteins in ways that computers can't do it and find these patterns and things, you know, this kind of thing. I pick it up. So he's at work, and that's where he works. And one of the main storylines is that his boss, he gets a new boss, a new supervisor at work, and he wants to cut costs, I think. And he wants to cut the program and not have to work with disabled people anymore. And he says, how about being solved, or not being solved, being cured of your autism? or disorder, mental disorder, and you'll still be able to do the work, but then you'll be able to not, we won't have to have a gym, and we won't have to have private offices, and we won't have to, you know, look after you in ways that normal people don't need looking after, because these people with autism, they can't deal with working with people, and they can't deal with loud noise, and they have to put music on to work, and because they all need their own specific music to work, they all have to have their own offices, and they have to have a gym to relax in, and all these different kind of things, and he doesn't want that to do. So he sort of half forces them in a way to sort of volunteer for this experimental treatment, which is also being developed by this same company that they work for, because I guess this company is some big corporation which has lots of different interests, and of course medical research is one of them, and they buy up the treatment, this experimental treatment, which is being developed at this other part of this work complex where they work, this this campus where they all work. And there's another boss as well, the immediate manager sort of tries to stop it and things like that. But the big question is, will they take the treatment, you know, not just Lou, but the other people that he works with, the other autistic people he works with, or will they not? Will they want to sort of change their personalities in a way to do it? And that's the big question here. Lots of stuff about identity and what actually makes people like what makes you you, and they're going, oh yeah, you'll be just the same, except you won't be autistic anymore. And there's a big question of like, if there is a cure for autism, should, you know, would people take it, or should we cure people of mental illnesses? And there's lots of stuff about that. Meanwhile, Lou is, he goes fencing as well. He doesn't tell anybody about this, but he goes like once a week on Wednesday nights, he goes fencing, and it's some kind of you know, some casual fencing group where they, if they go to a tournament, it's more of a sort of dressing up in medieval clothes kind of tournament and hitting sticks together rather than, you know, really serious fencing. So that's what he does. And there he hangs out with Jim and Bob and Doug and other people as well. And the way this has been set up is that who is it? I can't remember who the I think it's Joe is the guy whose home it is where he goes fencing. And Joe sort of sets it up as just sort of like a hobby and people could come round, but also it's sort of help out people who wouldn't normally have a good social life. So there's, is it Doug? I can't remember. Is it Bob? Maybe. Some guy as well who you can sort of see has problems as well. There's Marjorie, and you're not quite sure what Marjorie has got wrong with it. But you know, the thing is that this is what I'm sort of picking up with in the writing, because Lou doesn't notice this about the other people that he's with, but there it is in the writing. And I mentioned this in that other podcast that I talked about before, the SFF audio podcast, where it's a reliable narrator, but you can't really rely on him because he misses many of these cues. So the person that he's with, you know, like Lou does this and this person does this, but there must be a reason why people get together to fence once a week. And I don't really think it's purely just because they like fencing. I think it is because Joe and his wife, I think it's Loretta, they sort of want to bring these people together and help them out in some way. And they actually, you know, talk about this kind of thing, but Lou, I don't think, picks up in it in such a way. So Marjorie is some kind of love interest that Lou is interested in. That love interest that he's interested in. I didn't put that better. But she's just sort of like a girl who he really likes the colours in her hair and the way that she smells and things like that. He normally doesn't like smells, strong smells, because he's very sensitive to it. And then he's like, you know, Joe says, hey, you should take up fencing in a bit more seriously and go into a tournament because you're really good at it, because he uses his kind of pattern recognition to pick out patterns in the other person that he's fencing with at the time. And in that way, and I thought these passages were really quite interesting. Again, you don't really pick up that he isn't doing real fencing. He's doing sort of more play fencing like you do at a, like say, a sort of, what do you call it? A Renaissance fair kind of thing, where you get together and some people fence and some people knit and some people, you know, speak in funny languages, and he's the kind of, oh, fencing kind of thing. They don't really use the real equipment, but he, of course, he doesn't know really that much about it. But, so Joe says, hey, you should, you know, take up fencing. And there's these other like, subplots as well. And I was thinking, well, how are these all going to fit together? And I realized actually they don't need to. And even Joe says it at the same time. They sort of shake themselves out though and work thematically together, even though they don't connect that well as a plot. And it's really strange how the characters actually admit this in the book. Lou says, hey, how is me learning to fence and going into a tournament, how's that going to help out with the work problems? And, you know, Joe says, well, I'm not really sure it will be connected or it will help, but I think it will. I think if you do it, it'll actually help you in some way, but I'm not quite sure how, but it'll give you confidence, maybe. Like that, but maybe it'll work out. And there's another thing as well with, you know, with Bob or Doug. I can't remember the guy's name. The guy who has sort of a little bit of problems with at the fencing group, who doesn't understand disabled people quite as good as he should do, as well as he should do. And again, you think, well, how is that going to play into the main storyline? It sort of does, kind of, but it doesn't really. And like I say, quite refreshing. And all the way through, it's quite slow and nothing really that interesting happens, but I found it fascinating all the way through, because most of it is being told from the point of view of someone who has some kind of autistic spectrum disorder, kind of mental deficiencies. But then in some ways it slowly comes about that you think he's just an idiot, but then you realize actually no, in some ways he's a genius. And the story did keep me guessing all the way up into, like, there's this one part in the middle where there's this police investigation, and it's that sort of takes a huge part of the middle of the book, maybe too much time, and that really did remind me, in a way, of the Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, because that is, in a way, a mystery book, Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. I think that's a play on a Sherlock Holmes story. And so you do get a little bit of this mystery. However, Lou doesn't want to solve the mystery because he knows that it's going to make him unhappy to solve the mystery. So it's the opposite of the Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, where he's actively not thinking about the problem. And I thought that was quite, you know, like you say, quite refreshing in a book to have someone not want to deal with a problem and try to avoid a problem because he's got another problem at the same time. And because of that, I was never quite sure what he was actually, even though he was saying in this sort of first person present tense narrative what he was thinking, what he wanted, I was never actually quite sure what he was wanting because he wasn't admitting everything. So maybe in a way he wasn't a reliable narrator, because it's an autistic outlook, maybe he really doesn't know the kind of things that he's not saying but is implying, because that's what we think about as an unreliable narrator. They know things that you don't know, but they're keeping it to themselves on purpose, whereas in this way it's an unreliable narrator who doesn't know he's unreliable and isn't keeping it. Yeah, so very effective, and that actually kept me guessing up until the end of the book. And it does actually end not abruptly, but the last chapter is like a completely different story. Don't want to give away what happens really, but this is the main difference between this book and say Flowers to Algernon, where he just gets the treatment right at the beginning and then it goes through the details of that. In this book, it really isn't about that. It's about the lead up to and the question if he will take the treatment or not. And I'm not going to give it away, but even when it does happen, I was really surprised about it. And then the way it ends as well, I found even more surprising. And I thought this end in some ways was really, really disappointing and really sort of in a way far-fetched and in a way unbelievable, but yet at the same time really satisfying, because it really did sum up what the author, Elizabeth Moon, I think was trying to say about autism and about its cure and if cure is working and all these other different questions that it sort of talks about all the way throughout the novel. Then it kind of demonstrates it at the very end, but I don't want to give too much away, but I was, especially like the last chapter and the last few lines of the last little section, I thought, wow, that takes real balls to do that kind of thing at the end of a novel, in the same way leaving it completely ambiguous and in another way saying something very, very specific and saying something very, very clever. And I was really impressed by that. The characters in this book. Just to wrap up a bit about the plot and the story, way too long. I do actually think it was too long. But it did sort of bring in the viewpoint of the autistic character and the repetition, and I didn't really want that repetition. So even though the ending I thought was good and big sections of it and whole storylines are really good, I did think there was a little bit too much fluff. But then, like I say, character-wise and thematically, I think the fluff had to be in there. So let's talk a bit about more of the character. Writing style is one way to portray someone who has some kind of autistic disorder. I just started reading Flowers for Algernon, and that's very much there. It's, you know, right there in the punctuation. It's right there in the word choice, in the spelling and everything. Now, of course, I listened to this as an audiobook, and somebody, I just got a message on goodreads.com saying, how did you do this as an audiobook? You really need to read it. How does it even work? And to be honest, I don't know. I've not looked at the text at all. Maybe I should have, maybe if I go on to amazon.com, I can, you know, read the first chapter sometimes on Amazon. Maybe I should do that. But it was quite frustrating to... Actually, let me just talk about this now. The narration was done in... I made a note of the narrator this time, Jay Snyder. He read like a robot, but I don't think he should have necessarily had to have done that, because the writing itself and the word choice and the way that the sentences were very, like, declarative, very matter-of-fact. It's like, this is what happens, then this, then this, then this, and very few sort of value judgments and things. I thought that was enough to be able to sort of get the character of Lou from the writing. And also there was... you know, there was no, I don't know, what's the grammar term? Contractions. So it's like, it's never I'm this. It's always I am this. And there's no apostrophes in there. All of the words are spread out. It's sort of like very formal language. And even at one point, Lou says, someone said I talk in a stilted manner. And I don't understand what a stilted manner is. But then later on, he reads a textbook and he says, this is great. This textbook is exactly how I think. This is exactly how I talk. But now I understand what stilted words are. So it does read a little bit like a textbook. All the ums and the ers and all of the things which are implied normally when you're reading a book, which aren't there because you don't want to read people going and stuff. But it's in there. Of course, there's none of that in here at all. But like I say, listening to an audiobook, Jay Snyder suddenly makes him talk like a robot, and he talks very slow all the time. Thank goodness that on the iPod Nano, there's the same function as there is on the iPod Touch and the iPod and the iPhone, which is a little 2X button, which I don't actually think makes it goes twice as fast. I think it makes it go 1.5 times as fast, because, you know, just by timing it myself, I can't listen to a book or a podcast in twice the speed as normally. I think it turns out it's like 1.5 times the speed. But that's really good because it speeds it up and it's still very, very listenable too. I often listen to audiobooks in that way, but this, if it didn't have that, I think I would have fallen asleep a lot more than I did when I was reading this, because I've been on a cruise ship and because I don't have any book to read, and my iPhone isn't there. Normally I'd want to read sort of some ebooks as well, but I didn't bring any with me, and I don't really want to read them on my computer screen, but hey, that's it. So what we have is blow by blow everything set out, you know, day by day, almost hour by hour narration about, like I say, in first person present tense, from the point of view of an autistic character. And he notices lots of things, like patterns, and he, like, all the time he talks about the patterns, but he doesn't just notice the patterns, he tells you about the patterns. And even if he's not telling you about patterns, the way that the book is written follows the patterns of his mind. Like, this morning I do this, and then I drive to work, and then I do this, and then I do that, and then I go here, and then we do this, and then we do that, and then I go home, and then I sleep. And then the next day I do this, and then the next day I do this. And he, you know, you really find out about the patterns of his life, and then the patterns of his week. And not only the patterns of his week, the patterns of his relationship with his friends, the patterns of his fencing and things. And it does become, like I say, it becomes repetitive to read. However, I think this is an intentional decision that he just doesn't tell us about the patterns. We actually get to experience the patterns firsthand, which is very effective, if a little bit boring, and did sort of send me to sleep when I was sitting in a sun lounger on deck 13 and listening to the audiobook and just falling asleep immediately. Well, within a few minutes and stuff like that. So it's interesting. Anyway, also he noticed patterns. Like when he goes in, no, not patterns, colours too. So he often talks about colours and light glinting off things. For example, he goes into a parking lot and he's thinking about what other people would see, because he, you know, he does this whole lot of soul searching in this book about, because he's been asked, like, do you want to be not autistic anymore? And of course he's thinking, well, what would I be like if I'm not autistic anymore? And he looks at this parking lot, he says, okay, there's lots of cars here, and this one's, you know, there's 13 blue cars, 12, you know, other cars, and there's 7 of these cars, and I like 7 because that's a prime number, and all this kind of stuff. And he says, well, when other people look at a parking lot, what are they going to see except the color of the cars? What is there to see? He says, there's these cars and they're laid out in this pattern. What else is there to notice about the view about a parking lot? And I would think, well, of course, when I look at a parking lot, I sometimes notice the colours of the cars, but generally I don't notice the colours. I will notice if they're set out well. You know, if you go to Italy and you see a car park and all the cars are crammed in there and stuff like that. Completely different to a car park in India, completely different to a car park in Germany, completely different to a car park, in America and things like that. And I realise that he doesn't ever make value judgments. He never sees the conditions of the cars. He never explains how dirty something is unless sort of like the dirt infringes on him. If it's a little bit smelly, he notices people smelling. But he never makes any value judgments about, like I said, about if he lives in a place which is nice, if he lives in a place which isn't nice. You know, if it affects him, he notices it. But there's, like I said, very few value judgments about, like, when he goes to a supermarket. We never get the name of the supermarket or what quality the food in. He just says, well, this is laid out here and this is laid out there. It's like, would it be better if everything was laid out alphabetically? Oh, he doesn't say that, but that's the kind of things that you would, he mentions about the picking food and how to pick food out and things. He only makes these quantitative judgments rather than qualitative judgments in the way that he talks about fencing and someone says, well, what's your favorite kind of fencing? This is up to you. What do you want to do? And he's like, well, I don't really particularly like one kind of fencing more than another kind of fencing. They each have their individual things. And as he goes through this book, you find out how he sort of learns about value judgments and starts to make them. And also, some other things as well, which are a big part of him. He notices these funny turns of phrase and idioms and, he notices similes and metaphors and expressions and he comments on every single one of them, which does get a bit boring. It does get a bit tiring. And he notices all facial expressions. Like, he often talks about how shiny the skin is on the face and the looseness of the lips and the smiles in the eyes and the cheeks. And in some ways it's interesting because he understands group dynamics better or more clearly than some people, but he's not able to take part in them because he can't internalize them. He can't internalize the group dynamics and he can't internalize the facial expressions and use the knowledge that he has. However, it is amazing to see how he does notice everything, which maybe is what autistic people are like, but they can't use it. For example, there's this one point when he's looking at this group and they're talking about fencing and talking about competitions and tournaments and stuff like that. And he says, and you can always tell who's going to speak next because, he can't tell who's going to speak next because they look at each other, people glance at each other and make eye contact with each other. And there's hints there. And he works out the entire, status structure of the group, but he doesn't know that he's worked out the status structure of the group. He just knows that all of them look to one person a bit more, except this other guy who doesn't look to this one person a bit more, or he does, but it's less than the other people, but he looks at him half of the time instead of all of the time when he finished speaking. And he just doesn't understand what's going on, but he notices it, but again, like I say, he doesn't internalize it. And he does have bad social skills, but gets by and does develop over time. And this is what I really like about this book, is that the character development from the beginning of the book to the end of the book happens with one person. Nobody else has any character development at all. It's just one guy, and it's very, very subtle. From the time when he, is offered this treatment at the beginning of the book to the time when he makes a decision near the end of the book, there is character development, but it's not even tiny. I mean, he goes through a lot and does a lot, but the changes is, I don't know, it's really difficult to explain because he starts from a place which I can almost not identify with in any way, and he ends at a place which I can almost not identify with any way. And the steps he takes to get to these two places, which I don't really recognize, are very long and, like I say, a bit tedious, but it does, it works in a way which is, like I say, quite surprising, which I don't think I've really seen before in a novel. Unlike, say, Flowers to Algernon, where he starts a complete idiot, becomes a genius, the contrast there is amazing, and that's what the book is about, the contrast. Whereas this book, the contrast is so tiny, is so slight. That's how I see it. But that slight character development is something I find, like I say, again, very effective. There's lots of very effective things, and things that make this book very... it makes me think quite a lot as well. So there's different parts of his character which really stuck out to me. One of the most interesting parts is where he imagines what it'll be like to be normal, But he doesn't just imagine it, he sort of acts it out. And because the first-person present tense narrative works really well, that you don't get him looking at his life through any way... let me try to explain this. The writing style really works like this, because, like you say, if it was told from the point of view of the... of the end point of his character, you would get sort of him reflecting about how he used to be. So the way that it's being told continuously, and again, same way with Flowers for Algernon, which is like written as a diary, or as, you know, update progress reports. It's quite fun actually to read these two books back to back, even though I've not finished Flowers for Algernon. I did read it, what, 15 years ago or something like that. So, it's interesting to see that development over time. But this is the cool thing, is that when he suddenly goes, right, I'm now going to be a normal person for a few minutes, and tries to be that way, it's really scary in some ways. But then in other ways, it's, like I say, really effective. He suddenly goes, oh, I hate my mobiles. I hate the way the sun glints off things, and I hate the music, and I hate this and this. You know, I'm really annoyed by it. And then, you know, a minute later, he's back to him normally and goes, is that how normal people are? Anyway, really good. Other characters... I've got another note here. Oh yeah. Oh man, I've forgotten what I was going to say here. Oh yeah. So this is the good thing, is that because he does seem to sort of like improve with his own mental process, I was thinking, hey, wait a second, I know the twist that's going to happen at the end of the book. They've affected his memory somehow to make him forget that he's already agreed to go through the treatment at the beginning of the book, but he doesn't know because he hasn't told us, because he's forgotten with some kind of treatment, some kind of enforced amnesia. And now he's getting the treatment and he's slowly developing over time and improving, but not knowing. And the unethical sort of being, the way he's being forced by his boss unethically to take the treatment, it's not really unethical to go through, you know, it's not really unethical what they're trying to force him to do and trying to, you know, make him take these benefits, because it's not, because he's already agreed to it. And at the end, we're going to find out that he's been slowly improving all the time, and then it's going to be, of course, that didn't happen at all. In my own head, that's what one storyline could have been like, but it isn't that. It's way more subtle than that. In fact, the motivations of the boss and the motivations of the other people, that's why I mentioned this here, because of the other characters, I thought were a little bit shallow in some ways. But then throughout the book, you realize there's whole loads more going on there. Like I said before, that Lou doesn't pick up on the motivations of the other people. And we actually get these other viewpoint characters coming in. We get Joe... I think his name's Joe, and his man, who is his friend, who he goes fencing with, and the manager at work as well. We get a few little bits and pieces from their point of view, and we work out that the motivations of other people are more complex than Lou sees. For example, the reason why the boss wants to close down the unit at work where the autistic people work, it isn't just a money saving thing. There's other things going in there which are hinted at, and then is sort of explained in the epilogue. But it's only in the epilogue where you just go, oh yeah, of course that is true. I mean, I'd sort of worked it out beforehand, but it was good to know that the characters aren't as one dimensional as Lou sometimes sees them. They do have more depth there, and I think Elizabeth Moon was intentionally doing that. But again, it's effective. But it does mean that the other characters aren't actually that interesting to spend any time with. For example, there's Marjorie, who is the love interest, and Lou sees her in no way except that she's got a pretty face, the light glints off her hair, and she smells nice. And we know nothing else about her except the things that, you know, Marjorie tells him, like, oh yeah, I'm a student, and things like that. One second, there's someone at the door. Come in.
Hello,
Ed.
You okay?
Yeah, I'm okay.
You want me to do the bathroom?
No, nothing. Okay, but there's a tray here. There's a from room service here. If you could grab that's all I need, I think. Thanks a lot. I'm doing a show tonight, so yeah. So I won't need anything this evening. But thanks a lot. Cheers. Thanks a lot. Catch you later.
Yeah, see you later.
Okay, I'll go back and edit that out. Where was I up to? Yeah, Marjorie, not really a character with any depth. And I actually mentioned this before in the previous book about saying, oh, these two characters, what do they see in each other? How can they suddenly fall in love? And why are they, you know, why do they suddenly declare their undying love to each other? And I don't really see it there. Whereas in this book, I don't really see it either, except that the level that Lou is working on in terms of his, you know, emotional development in him trying to work up the courage to ask someone else really is at that kind of 12-year-old level. It's like, oh, I like you. Why do you like me? Oh, you got pretty hair. What else? Oh, you got you smell nice. You got good teeth. And that's probably about it. Like, the teeth line up in a pleasing pattern to Lou. And that's why she is suddenly the amazing love interest that she is. But then you think that because she is interested, I don't want to be like prejudiced in any way. But again, you understand that the people who go to this fencing group, that Lou thinks that they can have some kind of relationship and other people think that these two people can have some kind of relationship means there's probably more to Marjorie than Lou understands, and maybe even more to Marjorie than other people understand, even within the book. She is held at such a distance that we never get to know her, except that we know she is, you know, as a researcher in a medical company, or was it university? I can't remember, but she's some kind of researcher. It doesn't even matter. But there she is. And all the other characters are sort of like these ciphers, which we sort of see a little bit more about, but not much. Next note, science and technology. I didn't make any notes here at all, but I guess there's not very much of them. There is a bit, you know, there's some talk about space exploration, and of course there's the medical advances, but it's really not about that. It's very much an internal book about things that go on in the mind. Writing style, and things like that. Yeah, like I said, I've talked about this already going other ways, so nope, I don't need to. Don't think I need to go cover any of these notes. Oh yeah, except at some points it's very funny, and sometimes it's very sad, but it didn't really ever move me in like in a big way emotionally, more in like an intellectual way. It made me think more than it made me sad, in ways that other books, which are about people who might have some mental problems, can really, you know, can really affect me. For example, when I talked about Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, there's this one part where someone is completely crazy and he's going through obviously some kind of mental thing, but he brings out things about the world which really make me I don't even know what I'm trying to say here. Yeah, it made me cry. Put it that way. And there's very few books which do make me cry. And that wasn't specifically about, you know, the situation of the guy and his mindset, but it was sort of built up. And that's what I really liked about Slaughterhouse-Five, is that one of the most moving scenes, not, you know, there was a few times where it affected me and it's sort of like on a deeper level. But this one part where he's talking about, you know, he's watching a film about war and he experiences backwards. I was in tears when I was reading that. And then at the end of the book, they played this sort of like a narration playing music. I think it was an extract from the movie, which I've not seen, of Slaughterhouse-Five, and the narrator narrating that same scene set to emotional music, and I was like a blubbering wreck by the end of the book, by the end of the listening to the audiobook as well. I've talked a bit about the narration as well. Yeah, so bringing on to the themes, I think I've talked quite a lot about this. The book is called Speed of Dark, and the idea here is this question. I'm not spoiling anything, because they talk about right at the very beginning of the book, right in the first chapter, in the second chapter. And Lou is saying, well, how fast, you know, speed of light is set. We know how fast the speed of light goes in a vacuum. It travels at this constant speed, and it's the law of the universe that it travels at this one speed. But then he goes, oh, how fast does light travel? Messed up the entire point of that sentence. How fast does dark travel? And he says, because when the light gets there, the light has to be moving through something to be able to exist. So something has to be there before the light gets there, and that's dark. So it has to go through the dark. And there's this quite different kind of things. And as a literary device, it's really not bad at all, because he's talking about, well, before there's light, there has to be dark, and it gets there first. And before there's knowledge, there's ignorance, and that has to be there first. And before there's the good thing, there has to be a bad thing. And of course, that's what the whole book is about, you know, and it is sort of like bringing up to what may or may not happen at the end of the book. Some of the people in his unit go for the treatment, others of them don't go for the treatment. But it's talking about the darkness become that comes before the light. In other words, the maybe I'm giving away too much here, but it's the speed of dark is the autism or the ignorance that people live in before they either cured or they gain enlightenment as well. And this is also reflected a bit by the weather in the book and the seasons, but I don't want to give too much away there. Maybe I've already given away too much. It's sort of like a classic sort of, oh, it's spring. What's going to happen in the spring? Are people going to be healed? Yeah, maybe. But he doesn't take the treatment at the end. Or maybe he does take the treatment at the end. Maybe not. We'll see how it goes. Anyway, so my answer to this is, you know, what is the speed of dark? And the dark has to be the first. It's not true, actually, because the cosmic microwave background is everywhere and it infuses the entire universe and is measurable everywhere. Dark gets there at exactly the same time as the light, because the light is only light in one wavelength. And at the microwave, you know, cosmic microwave background, which is, you know, the heat, which the thing which keeps the entire universe above absolute zero and stuff like that. No, there's no such thing as absolute, you know, absolute dark, absolute cold, absolute zero temperature. There's light everywhere. That's my point of view on it, but it's not point of view. But then again, we didn't notice that until there was some pigeons on some microwave receiver and people won the Nobel physics award, you know, Nobel Prize for physics or whatever it is, for going, why can't we get rid of this microwave interference? Anyway, so that's a good thing, coming thing. Another one is, of course, change. People change. Can we embrace it? And I know I try to embrace change. And I think I've talked about, like, sort of my personal, some of my personal philosophy. And people enjoyed it when I sort of bring in my own personal story into these things. And because I really do embrace change. Earlier on this year, I wrote a song called Future Luke. And it was me in 2010. Sort of talking to future Luke, the person who isn't me now, but I will become in 2020, wondering what he's going to be like, and also talking about how I was back in 98 and 2002, and the kind of things I was doing then, and the kind of work I was working at, and what my life was like. And then I wrote this when I was in New York, and I didn't do many book reviews when I was there, but because I was doing other things. But I was talking about, well, my life at the moment generally consists of me cycling around New York every day, and that's a pretty awesome life, and I'm juggling for a living. But what am I going to be doing in 2020? And of course, I'm a different person than I was back when, you know, I worked in a school as a catering assistant in a school, and I was washing dishes for a living, you know. And my life has completely changed. My personality has completely changed. And I realized one of the things that let me put it this way. Over this year, one of my plans was to make new friends, because last year I broke up from my girlfriend, and I realized that in Berlin, and actually most of my friends that I'd made in the previous 5 years were people that knew me for the most part as Pola and me. And I guess you people who've been listening to this podcast for a long time, you knew me as, you know, there was me and there was Pola and we did stuff together and we were hanging out like that. So then I decided I need to make new friends who don't know me as me and Pola, as one half of a now ended relationship. I wouldn't say a failed relationship, but a now no longer existing relationship. I need to find people who get to know me as me as a single person. And I've realized that in doing that, I've actually discovered more about myself and embraced more about myself in a way for being for making new friends. The act of making new friends has changed me in an almost self-knowing way, but not in an intentional way, that by making new friendships, I have developed as a single person. My character has changed in some ways. And I know that now I'm a completely different person than it was this time last year. This time last year, I was still in that kind of like, sorry for me kind of point of view, even though I've been single for 4 months or something like that. I was still sort of regretting this relationship that I was going to have in the future, which now was no longer possible. Strange thing. And now, you know, I've got a different girlfriend, I've had a lot of fun this year, I've been doing different things like that. So there's these different questions, is that change is gonna happen, but maybe it isn't gonna happen. And there's a big talk about this book, and it's sort of like, with someone who's autistic, that change is dramatic, and should they try to embrace it, or is it better for them not to embrace it? And yet other people in the book want to stay the same all the way through, and they don't want to change. And there's another character who gets this implant in his brain to change his character, and people say, oh no, he's the same kind of person, it's just he won't be doing this anymore. And in some ways, the book makes this out to be a bad thing, and in some ways makes it out to be a good thing. That change is what you should, is going to happen, and you should accept it. And it made me think, it's like, okay, what if I could be autistic for a day? Would I try it? And I'm thinking, yeah, of course, you know, be autistic for a day, notice patterns, not be able to stand loud noises, and, you know, and not be able to understand social situations. And I thought, you know, this isn't explicitly stated in the book, but it made me think, I was like, well, how would I be if I was going to be autistic for a week? And then I thought, oh, maybe for a year. And I'd be like, would I want to be autistic for a year? And I think, well, that'd probably be a bit too much, but it would change me somehow. But then if I could change back again, maybe I'd give it a go. Maybe not for a year, but maybe, say, a month. It was like I went on holiday to New York for a month, and I sort of got a New York sort of mindset, and sort of, you know, I let New York change me in a way, and the things I did there, and cycling around on my bike and meeting musicians, and it did change me in a way. And I'm thinking, instead of having a holiday to New York, how about having a holiday to autism or Asperger's syndrome? And then I'm thinking, well, as long as I could come back, it'll be fine. Like, I didn't want to live in New York permanently. For a start, I probably couldn't afford it. Or I could, but to afford it, I'd have to work so much that I wouldn't spend any time in New York. And I'm thinking, well, maybe it's a bit like taking drugs. Earlier this year, I had quite a profound experience where I ate some special cake and then went to bed because I was a little bit... my back was playing up, and I thought I was going to be going out, and it was already late at night, so I ate some cake, and then I thought I'd be doing some more stuff, but then it was cold, and the next U-Bahn was 15 minutes, and the other guys who I was with, I was just like, look, I'm not really feeling up for it, I'm going to go to bed. So I was quite tired, and I went to bed, completely stoned out of my head, and I don't think I'd ever actually been that stoned before. Well, I have been. I went to in 99, I went to this music festival and watched the eclipse down in Cornwall when the solar eclipse, the total solar eclipse was visible in the UK. And I was next to these people dealing drugs, and they wanted to make some hash fudge. And so they said, can we borrow your stove and your saucepan to make this fudge? And I said, yeah, no problem at all. I said, but whatever you do, don't clean the bowl. I'll clean the bowl. In other words, I'll lick the bowl out. So they gave it back to me, and they hadn't even sort of scraped it out fully because they were like, just like, yeah, you can finish this off. So I sat there like licking this hash fudge out of this saucepan, and I'd never eaten cannabis before. So I didn't really know how it was going to affect me. So I was eating it and eating it and eating it, and it was just not having any effect. And then I finished it and put it away and washed the pan and the ladle, or the wooden spoon that I, you know, the mixing spoon. And then about 20 minutes later, I was laying on my back in the tent, convinced I was going to die. And for about the next four or five hours, I was convinced I was going to die, even though, you know, nobody has ever died of a marijuana overdose in the world ever. I was convinced I was going to be, I was like, I'm going to be the first person I'm going to die. So that was one experience. But it was a weird experience. But this time, I wasn't that stoned. I wasn't like overdosing on hash fudge, but I was a bit weird, and I was sitting there listening to this podcast called You Look Nice Today, and it was just the most amazing, the funniest podcast I've ever listened to. And as I was laughing about literally, they would say a joke, they'd say something funny, I would think, that's funny, I'm gonna laugh, and then I would laugh, but between thinking that's funny and I'm gonna laugh, I'd actually forgotten what the joke was that I was laughing at. And it was just profound that I was thinking, I'm laughing and my mind is being controlled in ways that, and it's being freed in other ways and things like that. And yeah, it was one of those profound, like, life-changing experiences. However, I woke up the next day, bit of a headache. I'd been drinking the night before as well. And yeah, and it was a bit weird thing. I like had a holiday to somewhere that could affect me. But like I say, you could come out the other side of it. But if I was like that all the time, say, you know, that's a bit like in Flowers for Algernon, which is clear to me because I've started reading it this morning, of course, that he doesn't remember anything. Things happen to him. The memories are there, but the memories are locked away. And it was this experience where I couldn't remember literally a quarter of a second beforehand, yet it was affecting me emotionally, but intellectually it wasn't affecting me. It's like the opposite of, you know, autism, where things affect someone, like, in some ways, but emotionally, they're disconnected. Anyway, I can't remember where I was going this. Change and embracing change. And I do think that people should embrace mental change. However, it is a bit weird when something is set up as a cure. Now, if I could be cured of my forgetfulness, in fact, to be the thing is, I think I'm pretty much, you know, mentally, I'm quite well sorted. I'm quite balanced. I'm, you know, generally very contented and happy with life and things. If someone said to me, what would be the one thing that you would want to change about your brain to improve yourself or change yourself in some way? I don't really think that there's much or very much that I would want to change in a way. I don't think I need to be happier at all. I don't think I need to be sadder at all. I don't think I need to be more serious. Like I say, I'm pretty well balanced, but it's only when I have these other experiences, like I say, being dumped by a girlfriend, going to New York, taking drugs, all these other things that can happen, sort of like reflect on me, but in a way it's good that I can change, but it's a natural thing. So I don't know where I want you to go with that, but yeah, this book really made me think about lots of different things, and about embracing change was one of the main themes that I got out of this book as well. So yeah, what's that, weather? Oh, I mentioned that as well. Yeah, there's another bit as well. He talks, this is a strange thing, that it, there's a suddenly that he suddenly goes, oh, I go to church. And I was like, oh yeah, he goes to church. And then suddenly he goes, oh yeah, of course I believe in God. And it's one of those things which sort of grabbed me in a way that I think, wait a second. You know, it reminded me of the Robert J. Sawyer book, where suddenly we learn that, oh, wait a second, this Neanderthal expert who sequences genes is also a Christian. And it suddenly goes, whoa, wait a second. Someone who is a genetic biologist who are like, you know, massively atheistic or agnostic in a way, which is well, like all statistics say that, you know, the population 10%, you know, numbers off the top of my head, but they sort of say, okay, 10% of the population are atheistic, 90% of scientists are atheists, 99% of biologists are atheists, because, you know, evolution sort of takes you down that road. And suddenly, part of the way into the book, we find out this person who has got like a Nobel Prize, well, maybe, I'm not sure if it's a Nobel Prize, but she's got a massive, you know, accolades for sequencing genes in Neanderthals, which is, you know, purely, yeah, I would say almost a purely kind of molecular biology kind of point of view. And suddenly, oh no, you know, I do believe in God. And then she talks to a caveman about all this kind of stuff. Well, not a caveman, Neanderthal, the opposite of a caveman, actually, a sophisticated Neanderthal. And then again, when I was reading Calculating God, you get this atheist and this alien comes down, and the alien believes in God. And in the end, I'm like, well, what the hell does God need a spaceship for? And all these different kind of things. And it was a little bit like that. But then I thought, no, I'm going to excuse it in this book, because I really don't know how the mind works. At some point he goes, yeah, I live in this street, on this place, in this town, in this country, on Earth, which is part of the solar system, part of the galaxy, part of the universe, part of the mind of God. And I really quite like that he sees the universe as a pattern in the mind of God, and has some quite, you know, some more interesting religious kind of thoughts in this book than you would normally get. But again, I don't really know what someone with autism would think about that, whereas I do know, I think I'm more of an expert in things that people have statistics about, which is the more scientific you get, especially in sort of biology and evolution kind of things, the less religious, or the less, well, not so much less spiritual, yeah, but the less sort of like classically religious you can be. And I don't think this guy is classically religious, so I think it does fit in well, quite well, with his personality, and it fits well into the book. Next thing in my notes. Oh yeah, conclusion. Really strange thing, because I reckon this book could have cut four hours out of the audiobook, maybe 100 pages or something like that. It really did affect me with the length, and I think a lot of this is due to the repetition. I admire, and it's quite refreshing to read a book which is almost intentionally too long and intentionally too repetitive, but it doesn't actually make the reading experience any better. And again, it's a bit weird to read a book with like the characters in it are very one-dimensional, but then it's intentionally that way. And then the soul searching is a little bit too sort of turgid, which is in a way intentional. And the progression of the character is a little bit annoying, but that's intentional. And even the ending of the book, which is in some ways infuriating, but in some ways satisfying, it's intentionally infuriating. And it's really weird that I want to, like, I think this book is a more ballsy book than it could be, but in the end I did fall asleep more times reading this book or listening to this audiobook than I do normally. I think it's because I wasn't being quite as active, but you know, all the time I was always wanting to get back to it, but it didn't stop the fact that I did fall asleep quite a lot. So it was a reading experience, like, 3 stars. But then as a book which made me think and sort of made me view the world in a different way and sort of made me think about interaction and made me think about change and made me think about mindset and stuff like that, it's actually a really good book. But most of that comes from thinking about it when I wasn't reading it, but that is still involved in it. And I'd want to give it like four stars for that, but then I think would want to give it 3 stars. So I'm going to give it 3.5 stars, but it's sort of like a high 3.5 stars, but not 4 stars. Maybe I'm going to give it 3.9 stars. Yeah, let's give it 3.9 stars. I'm going to give it 3.5 because I think it's one of those books which is better to think about than to read. And I think I think the ideas in this book could have been presented a lot better, like maybe as a lecture or as an essay or as a shorter story. I think it could have been a lot shorter and still got the thing, like maybe not quite as many as the disconnected subplots, or maybe less time repeating about how much he likes the way that the hair of his love interest sort of glints in the light. And so, but maybe that's part of it. So, I was writing some music. I've decided, here's a little bit of a project for this year, well, the end of this year, next year. My project for this year, or one of my list of 50 plans and goals for 2009, which I had, which I might talk about in an end of year podcast, maybe, I'm not sure. One of my plans and goals was to write an album's worth of music, and so I wrote 12 songs, one per month. And I'd already written a song for December, but I was thinking, well, I want to write another song because next year, one of my projects, or the beginning of next year, first half of next year, I want to write, and I've already started, there's an album of pop songs, but each pop song has to be under 2 minutes long, and it's going to be called 2 Minute Pop. Maybe, I don't know, that's the working title of this thing. And it's going to be a short album because it's going to be 10 songs, each of them 2 minutes long, or maybe 11 songs, I'm not sure. But it's only going to be taking 20 minutes to listen to in total. And even if you don't like pop music, it's like, well, it only takes 20 minutes. And even if you don't like any of the individual songs, we're like, oh, it's going to be over in 2 minutes time. It doesn't matter, I'm just going to give it a listen. Sort of an idea, you know, I'm not sure if it's like there's any sort of artistic integrity or anything new about this, but it's just a nice idea. So every time I'm writing a song, I pretty much want to, you know, write and record it in one day, the next day sort of, you know, fix up the track, and then that's it. So it's going to be like a 24-hour project, you know, just start it, write it one evening, finish it off, like master it and make an MP3 copy, you know, and by the next day. So anyway, I was two nights ago, I started writing a book, and I was just coming up to the end of this book as well. No, I started writing a song, and I was coming up to the end of this book, and I had some musical ideas, and I thought, oh, I'm going to write a song about this book, sort of inspired by this book. And so I'm going to play it now, because, you know, might as well. It's only 2 minutes long. If you don't like it, it's only 2 minutes. That's the whole point of this this musical project. The idea of this this project is to sort of like sort of express what I like about pop music, even though pop music isn't my favorite kind of music. But I really like pop production. I like enjoy making music in this kind of way. You won't understand all the lyrics, but then again, it's based on a character of a book of someone who's sort of autistic and sort of is overwhelmed by stuff. So there's kind of the point that you're not going to be able to pick out the lyrics in this song. But yeah, enough explaining, and here it is. Ladders dancing sometimes, patterns on the mobile. I lose myself in time, only for a short while. Silver, gold, blue and green, bring my focus nearer. Nothing, nothing, nothing can be clearer. That's the song. I hope you enjoyed that. Now, tradition, which is coming on, I'm going to look at goodreads.com, see what listeners of this podcast thought about the book. Friends reviews, 7 reviews. Here we go. Average 4.25 rating, star rating. Tamahome rated it 4 stars. Pretty good. It's kind of a mainstream book, except the narrator is autistic. Near future, though. So autistics are a little more functional. Oh, he's repeating my review. Maybe I should have read his... All done, good ending, not too long, a little restless with the Robert J. Sawyer type soul searching in the middle. Oh, that's good. Michael rated it 4 stars, Chris rated it 4 stars, Sandy rated it 5 stars. Good book here. He goes, I may need to review my top 10 shelf to see what can be bumped. The speed of book, the speed of dark book moved me like few books ever have. I cried, I laughed, I didn't want it to end. Well, I was the opposite in that way. I did laugh, I didn't cry, and I was wanting it to move on a little bit quicker. Anyway, like I say, I'm not taking much away from it. So that's pretty much it for this podcast. It's I thought I didn't have much to say about this book, but it turns out that when it's thematically strong, when there's a lot to it, which makes me think, I can talk a lot more about a book, which is pretty good, rather than just talking about plot and talking about setting and things like that and technology and stuff, which is, you know, not that interesting. So a little bit of news, feedback wise I'm thinking the way it's going to work from now on is that still send me emails, anything that you want. Email is still the best way to get hold of me, and I do reply to every email. If you want to ask a question and you don't want the reply, or if you want some special attention, email me luke@juggler.net. any question, any feedback, anything at all. The other way, though, if you want to like comment specifically about an episode, what I think I'm going to do now is try and push that more over to goodreads.com in the blog post for this podcast episode, which will be on sfbrp.com. From now on, I'm going to put links directly to my review on goodreads.com, which it doesn't say anything. I never really do a full review there. It always just says, listen to this podcast episode. But the way it works is if you can then comment on my podcast, on this episode and about the book itself, if you've got anything like that, because then other people can share in these comments. Go to goodreads.com and find it there. Like I say, there'll be links provided directly from the website. Also on the website, I've put some lists of the books up online. I think I mentioned this in a previous podcast, but if you, there's now 3 lists. One of them is sorted by chronologically, so just, you know, by episode. There's another list sorted by rating as well. So if you want to see which books I've rated highest and lowest and stuff like that, and you can click straight through and download them and see the blog post and see everything about them there as well. And the other one is sorted by author. So if you want to see all of the books, say, by Elizabeth Moon that I've reviewed, you can just see them easily there in one list. I think that's the best way to keep track of these podcasts now, hopefully. So normally I don't really tell people to go to sfbrp.com, but it's hopefully becoming a little bit more useful in that way. Otherwise, yeah, you can follow my blog, lukeburge.com/blog. Follow me on Twitter. I'm @LukeBurge on Twitter. You can read my own fiction. That's lukeburge.com/fiction.html. You can read my own works as well. Yep, I think that's about it. Thanks for listening, and I'll catch you next time.